Welcome to the Coaching and Therapy channel. So this channel is quite close to my heart because I train coaches in embodiment. I mean, why? Because if you don't work with the body, you're missing a lot. Whether you're a coach, a therapist, facilitator, whatever, that's how you go deep quickly. That's how you do stuff that's sticky. We have to take the body into account. This channel is sponsored by Dylan Newcombe and Uzazu Embodied Intelligence. Dylan is a genius, quite simply put, and I wouldn't say that about many people in this field. I've been studying with Dylan for, God, the first time was probably 10 years ago in the Netherlands. Speaks fluent Dutch, by the way, as well as Korean and a few other languages. What I love about Dylan is his ability to make models of things, looking at how embodiment works. His system, Uzazu, U-Z-A-Z-U, is really all about state shifting. So I think of him as the sort of master of state changing, how we can shift our state, our client's state, and how we can develop ourselves through those different ways of being. So I think for coaches and therapists, it's like easy to learn, practical toolkit. I've used it myself over the years. So if you want a 3-day online training with Dylan, then look at the link below, or you can go to Uzazu, uzazu.org. And even easier, he's got an embodied assessment there you can do as well. We all love doing these little tests about ourselves, but this is an embodied one. So there you go. Welcome to the Coaching and Therapy channel. I'm going to be on this one a lot just because there's lots of cool people on here. Lots of people, I think, you know, well worth a listen. Embodiment in facilitation is so necessary. So from me to you, welcome.
Okay, great. Thanks very much. Thank you, Manal. Thank you, Matthew, for finding some space for this subject. I was listening to Philip Shepherd's talk a couple of days ago, and he dropped something into one sentence, just a tiny little moment, and something in my imagination lit on it, and I thought, that has to be in the conference somewhere, that subject. And the subject was the fact that imagination is vital to a vital component of our neurology. And it lit up in me, and I thought, we have to do something about that in the embodiment conference. There's something, I encountered a moment about a year ago with some people I was working with where we were doing some embodied work together, and I said, something slipped out of the side of my mouth, which was, imagination is embodied. And everyone in the room went, oh. It's interesting because there's a kind of cultural idea, I guess, that imagination sits somewhere outside of you, and that where is imagination if it's not embodied? And then imagination often gets outsourced. We were talking before in the 15-minute lead up. Imagination often gets outsourced to the creative arts or creativity. And I thought to begin the session just to introduce the subject and to demonstrate the principle in a really simple way will bring ourselves to present. I'll take you through a little guided somatic process to bring us all here now. It's 2 o'clock in the morning here in England. It's actually 3 o'clock technically, because our clocks just went back an hour ago. And I know, Manal, it's 5 o'clock in the morning there in Saudi Arabia, Matthew at 3 p.m. in New Zealand. We're all over the place. So let's all come together first, and let's use the tool of our imagination to make that happen, right? Does that feel like a good thing to do?
Super.
Great. So to begin with, I'd like you to imagine the place where your sit bones are touching the seat. Feel where your sit bones are on the seat. And then see if you can imagine them. Can you get a picture of them in your mind's eye? And then where your feet are touching the ground, notice where your feet are making contact with the floor. And can you get a picture of where every single little toe, your little toes, first of all, the little toe on the right-hand side of your foot is touching the ground, and the fourth toe, and the fifth toe, the fourth toe and the third toe, I'm counting the wrong way. And the second toe and then the big toe. See if you can get a visual image in your mind's eye of the circle that your big toe is making, the imprint your big toe is making on the ground. And taking your attention over to the left foot and notice where the big toe on the left foot is touching the ground, making contact. And where the second toe is making contact. Notice they're not all even. Where the third toe is making contact. Fourth toe. And fifth toe. And can you get a picture in your mind's eye of how that little toe is making contact with the ground or your shoe or whatever, wherever it finds itself? Can you get a picture in your mind's eye of how much, what's the radius of that circle? What's the circumference of that circle? Making contact. Great. And now bringing yourself back to the screen and noticing how you are. You feel a little bit more here. Even though all we did was pay attention to where our toes were touching the ground, right?
Right.
Pretty powerful tool. And there's something that I've been powerfully impacted by in my Feldenkrais training. I'm just about to graduate from a 4-year Feldenkrais teacher training. And that's why I was very excited to have Carl Rabke, because he's a bit of a master. He's been a practitioner for a long time. And one of the things that Moshe Feldenkrais, who was the founder of that method, happened upon was the understanding that we are thinking movement before we do it. That if we can imagine a movement, it's much more likely to be achievable. If we can't imagine a movement, it's like it's not part of our self-image. So the imagination is really integrally connected to our motor cortex and our sensory cortex, our sensory functions. And this idea of the phantom limb, right, is really closely connected to this idea that that there is a map that we're imagining that is also something that's somehow felt somewhere between feeling and seeing, somewhere between feeling and seeing. And it's a truth of being in a body. The word phantom is a bit of a misnomer. There is a map that you were creating then in your motor cortex as you imagined down to your toes. There's a map you're creating. A neurological map, a pathway that by even imagining it begins to create the pathway. And that is like, right?
Yeah.
Fascinating. That's just fascinating to me. Yeah. So this, there's a Feldenkrais practitioner called Roger Russell who came and was a trainer for us during our training, and he gave me one of those moments of he was one of those masters who walked into the room and he was trying to explain to me this idea of a neural imaged map of me and how a practitioner, you might know a little bit about this, Matthew, as an osteopath. I'm sure you do, that the map that the practitioner is working with and imaging is corresponding with the imaging that's happening inside the person or the client, the patient, the student. In Feldenkrais, they would be called a student. In osteopathy, they'd be called a client, a patient, right?
A patient, yeah.
Yeah. So he held my right foot, and he first of all started rocking through my skeleton. And then he said, look, there's T12. And then he said, and that's L5S1, L4, L3. And he showed me every single vertebra through pushing through my foot, and I could image it. I was imaging all of it. I could see it all. I could see the map of my skeleton through the very subtle impact he was making through the direct pressure through my foot, through my skeleton. And that blew me away. That was like Jedi stuff. Because he was naming it rather than just, because normally when you're working with someone who's got that kind of skill level, they're just often doing it in a non-verbal way. But because he was able to articulate it and I could see it, it was like, as far as I was concerned, evidence. Like it was, and it's totally changed my practice and how I work with people with touch. Do you have anything to add there, Matthew? I reckon you might have some things to add there.
I recognize that as a fairly critical clinical skill.
Right.
There's a check-in in myself prior to exploring the movement patterns of a patient, because I'm also mapping their movements before I'm examining them. So there's a sense of connection to the field and the movement patterns they're occupying and how to conceptualize them or take that on in some way.
Yeah. Could we put Matthew on the screen? It'd be lovely to, we've had a request from Judith.
Yeah.
Great.
Thank you.
Hi, Matthew. Thanks.
That's a spotlet. And Manal, you can come in if you take spotlet off and put us in gallery view, then all three of us.
Let's do that.
As a
network.
Slightly dyslexic. And that, we had another voice. That capacity to map things out in three dimensions has worked very well from me. Mm. And that's felt sense, seeing, exploring that. Mm. Getting a sense then you can pick out the history of injury, emotion. As an osteopath, this one of the second or third rule in principles is that the musculoskeletal system is the primary mechanism of human expression. So I'm looking for the story they're telling with the bones and getting a sense of how much of that is the computer screen and how much of that is disassociation and dismay and disappointment in their work. Mm. And what are the movement patterns they're representing? Mm. And then when I'm examining them, yes, I can pick out what level of L1, 2, 3, 4 in a foot movement that I'm attending to. And also then the quality of movement there, how much of that is they're sitting on their sit bones, slumped, not giving attention to them. Mm-hmm, and it's a mouse. Or how much of that is they're being undermined at work. Mm, the felt sense difference as well.
And that's, the more refined your system can be as a practitioner, the more clear you can read, right? The reading becomes more refined.
Mm. Yes, I think when I looked at the fifth year students when I was studying, they looked like gods, and I was, no, I'm their special and I'm not going to get there. And then you get to fifth year and you realize, no, I'm nothing special at all, and it takes another 7 years to get a sense of, well, I've got some bits. I can learn that.
Yeah.
30 so years on.
30 years,
That, who am I in the relationship? I did a piece of work around belly dancing and explored shimmy and square movements and realized that I'd got a little bit in me that wasn't, that I found. In everything else I was doing, I was okay. So it didn't show up in yoga, didn't show up in circuit training, in all kinds of expression. But in learning belly dancing, a square movement across my pelvis and hips and a shimmy that was stuck. And then I realized, I'm tracking that with my patients, and that's part of my mapping of them.
Yes, yes, yes.
And that's not health, that's something I need to just check in. So you start, when you get to 20 years in, realizing what is my projection and how to be cleaner on that.
Yeah, and I don't know if, I suspect that doesn't ever stop. So today I was in, I've been doing Feldenkrais for 20 years, and today I was in a training and I've got a hypermobility pattern. And there's something about a hypermobility pattern, especially if you've got a dance training like I do, where the extension has been so favored, like the full extension has been so winning. People like it and they compliment you on it. And to find the extremity is no effort for me. I sleep in the extremity, you know, it's no effort. But to find the places in between are actually the difficulty for my pattern. And the more, and this kind of layers of awareness of that, I have to keep working out how to imagine these in-between places. And then I can refine my awareness and be a much more, yeah, effective practitioner.
I'd like to jump in here.
Go.
I'm listening to this from not a practitioner lens. So doing Feldenkrais, and it just hit me when you started talking, Rachel, it is about imagination. Mm. Is imagining that, you know, that tiny movement and that we forgot that it existed in us, you know, and that tiny muscle that, which one would move. And to begin with, at least for me, there was a big part of it, imagination of, let's, because we technically, we can't see what's going on. Mm. We can sense it. And for me, imagining it, so if I'm walking and I'm imagining how the tiny foot bones are interacting together, that makes me, you know, the sensation of it is heightened. Mm. And it's like, wow, it's right in front of me. It's like, wow, it is about imagination. It's
yeah.
It's like a big revelation. It's like, oh, it
yeah.
is.
Yeah. And when we can't imagine a movement, it doesn't exist for us. So it's just like the darkness. Like, you don't know what you don't know, right? You can only know what you know. And so this piece about, there's something about the magic of imagination and hanging around in the darkness, hanging around in the uncertainty, hanging around in the place of, and this is where artists kind of know about this, they're comfortable with hanging around in the I don't know-ness a bit, or they've got a few more tools maybe, but it's often very frustrating to be in that place of I don't know-ness and stumbling around in the dark. But it's absolutely essential to be willing to be in the dark to discover what you might know next, right? It's like a catch-22. Yeah.
And we have comments about, you know, Qigong, imagination plays a big role. It's also someone else about, you know, thinking of continuum, micro movement, imagination, and you know, mindfulness is a bit of imagination, visualization is a bit of imagination, imagination. So it's,
there's a really lovely game in, I learned it from an Alexander teacher actually, where you stand tall with your arms out like this, and someone tries to push your arm. Have you done this? Tried to push your arm down, and it's very easy. And you try and hold it really straight, and you try and use all your strength, and you plant your feet on the floor, and you use your core muscles and all of this, and it's still quite easy to put your arm down. But if I imagine that I'm beaming a light out through my fingertips, through the wall, out into space or wherever, it's almost impossible to pull my arm. It's a totally different experience. And that still is profound to me, just a subtle imaginative shift or just working with an image can completely transform my neuromusculature.
Yeah, and you know, that also is something that is, you know, I did a bit of Aikido, and that's where they, you know, it's the energy or the water flow with the hand, so you're not blocking it.
Yeah.
And someone put in the chat kinesiology, where that's what it is. So imagination is such a powerful
Yeah, often underestimated, I think. Someone's written, men find it very hard to operate in the unknown. Oh, see, I would challenge that, knowing a lot of artists as I do, but maybe you're talking about the field of, so Paul's challenging that too. I reckon some blokes might have some things to say about that. But, maybe there is definitely a load of women attracted to embodiment work at the moment. I've definitely noticed that trend.
Yeah. The numbers in the conference, didn't we have 95% were women 4 weeks out, and then that changed and the percentage got up to about 28% of men, but only in the last week and a bit.
That's interesting. The numbers
started to become more representative.
Yeah, that's
maybe really there were last minute entries, but
that's really interesting. So another subject that we wanted to touch on was this theme of, so I'm a theatre practitioner. That was kind of my first training, really, I trained as an actor. And we're really taught to be very elastic in our imagination. And we're taught that imagination is kind of the biggest gift of a theatre maker, because you are in a set of given circumstances that you need to live inside as if it was true. For all intents and purposes, for the period of time of the play, that is your entire truth. And if you diminish that or compromise that or play it only half, then you're letting the whole thing die. And that's a very powerful tool to be able to learn to use. And I met a lot of actors who started using that tool out of school, if you like kind of abusing the superpower. They knew how to invoke certain things in order to have effects on certain people in a way that didn't feel quite ethical. My imagination helps me walk with a leg I do not feel. Ah, yes. Yes, that's, yes. Well, that's the neural mapping thing we were talking about at the start.
Rachel, there's a question here. Is imagination only through the mind or through sensing? And how do they correlate? That's quite a...
Yeah, I think it's a... do not believe that. I don't have any experience of the mind being separate from the body, do you?
Nope.
I contest anyone who comes to me and tells me that the mind and the body should be regarded as separate. That's really, and energy does follow thought, like Paul says, and a thought is action, like Paul Linden says, a thought carries action inherent in it. There was a really lovely talk I saw by, I'm going to say his name wrong, Teokasin Ghost Horse. He was on the ecology and research panel, and he's a Lakota elder and wisdom holder and podcaster and dude. And he was talking about his language and very, very articulately, given that he was explaining it in English. I really recommend catching it if you can. I felt like it was one of the fundamental ones for me, of the ones I've seen. And he talks about now having no nouns, and that nouns make things dead, and that verbs are living words, and verbs bestow living on things. So the heart, there's no name for the heart in Lakota language. The heart is something that roughly translates as living treeing, which I just love. Living treeing.
Yeah.
And that brings me to, you know, Paul Linden again. It's not that I'm angry, I'm angrying.
Lovely. Yes. I'm angrying. Yeah.
I'm angrying. It's an action. Someone is asking, anyone can spell his name. We'll find that. No,
I can actually. I can put it into the chat because I know how to spell it, but I can't.
Go ahead, Matthew.
Mind is an Anglo-Saxon word. It's nominalized. It means where you hold your attention. It should never have been dissociated or separated in that sense.
Yeah.
We do have three brains. We have a storytelling brain at the top. We have a heart brain, and we have a gut brain, and each brain dreams, and ideally you want them in sequence, but each conceptualizes the world in its own way.
I quite
and all threaded together by the vagus nerve, right? All threaded. Manal, were you going to say something?
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, recently, you know, I'd like how Dan Siegel defined, you know, or his definition of mind. It's a process, and it's about energy and information flow, and it's and he distinguished between the brain and the mind, which is fascinating. And his three things, it's actually the mind, the brain, and the relationship, which is quite interesting. Mm. You know that, but it's gonna, it's taking a bit of time to get out of this mind, body kind of separation and thinking of the mind as the head. It's a bit changing, I'm seeing in many places, but it's still not the the common look or perspective, I guess.
No, it's not. I bomb into everything. Oh, with your foot. Yeah, Evelyn. Bump. Yes. Yeah. Qijong, standing can be described as uprighting, not upright. And I love, someone wrote on some chat in this wonderful conference the other day on Facebook, they wrote, balance, there's no such thing as being in balance. There isn't, there's only balancing. I think that might have been Dylan Newcombe.
Yeah.
So this sense of active verbs helps our imagination engage with what we're doing. And in acting training, this is a really interesting little parallel. In acting training, we go through our script and we put in action words to describe what we're doing in every single moment. And I could be saying a sentence like, I've got to wash the dishes. And my action in that sentence, I've got to wash the dishes, might be to punish. Punishing. I am punishing with this sentence. I've got to wash the dishes. Or I am absolving. Can you imagine? A totally different quality. It's a totally different doing. I'm absolving through washing the dishes. What else could I be doing? I'm pacifying. I am practicing. I'm practicing. Yeah. You could put almost any verb in there, any action word, and it totally transforms the quality of the doing of the thing. And for an actor, that's like your exoskeleton. Those little points are little rocks you can step on that guide you through, that they're reliable pathways through the play. Do you mean different intentions from the action? It's just called actioning. It comes from Stanislavski, who was an acting guru at the beginning of the 20th century, came from Russia. It's called actioning. So I go through and I action my script, but they are intentions, yeah. Mm-hmm. And they sit inside another, so they're relational, and that's interesting as well. So it's not just something, I'm not doing it to myself, I'm in active, dynamic, relational effect the whole time. Even if I'm with silence or in retreat, like retreating or, yeah. So you could,
intertwined, says that Shakespeare quote, jog on the footpath way and merrily hent the stile, eh? A happy heart goes all the way, a sad one tires in a mile, eh?
What's that from, Matthew?
Winter's Tale.
I don't know it.
The frontal cortex is a conceptual idea of the world and the story that it tells, and the motor cortex are intertwined. So whether that's the anxiety of being on the start of a race and thinking about something that's undermining 5 years of training to get to an Olympic stage, or showing up in whatever form, that frontal cortex relationship, the motor cortex, determines the engagement of that muscle, that idea of a laser coming out of your fingertips, changing the amount of strength that you can muster in connection to the conceptual world. And in work with patients where I'm using mirror boxes, where they've had chronic pain syndromes, you wouldn't necessarily use that with a phantom limb, but where you're putting a box over a limb and the patient sees a reflection of their other limb. And you do two things to the limb that hasn't had a problem. So this is an example from a patient with an ankle injury, 2 years of fairly intense discomfort, a loose body that had led to horrible pain and a pain complex. And I identified the loose body that was whipped out in surgery, but he still had this extraordinary experience of pain. Putting a mirror box over that whole limb, so she looked at the reflection of and saw two limbs. And I worked on stroking her, and she saw the reflection being stroked. And it took about 6 weeks, but the way her brain mapped the experience and imagined it as, I'm being doing something to both legs, there's a mirror. But the one that used to be in terrible pain, even with a feather touch, no longer responded that way.
Yes.
So something was changing, and then the brain could doubt it, and that vigilance de-escalated.
Oh, that's a fascinating story. What a beautiful story. And it reminds me of, to take us back to a Feldenkrais reference again, the principle that the corpus callosum works on, that's a kind of a photocopy function in the brain that notices when something is happening on one side and seeks to create balance. So if you're doing an exploration with one leg, maybe bringing the foot to standing with the knee in the air while you're lying on your back, for example, this leg, even though it's long, is learning something. It's learning something so that when it comes to its turn to do it, the pathway is already it's already established in some homeopathic way. There's something that's already started to happen in that leg. Beautiful.
We've got a character, I think, Paul Cohen, commenting quite a lot. I think it's the same Paul Cohen who's got an extraordinary yoga studio in Auckland.
Oh, great.
Conversation. While we're waiting, if the other characters are going to join us.
Looks like Carl's coming. Carl's here. They thought it was the next day. They thought it was tomorrow. But there is no midnight tomorrow, is there? It's all over.
Yes, correct.
There's the...
I get the feeling Paul's got some interesting stuff going on, Paul, in the chat.
He's got a really interesting yoga studio in Auckland and a whole load of experience that's quite extraordinary. So if you want to invite somebody in that could add to this conversation, but it might end a bit yogi, a bit clinical, if you're happy with that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just, because Carl's just turned up, no offence, Paul, but I would really love to hear Carl's contribution to this subject as well. And I would... I would like to see if we can take it in some other directions other than just body work. Carl, hey!
You're muted, Carl.
Yay!
Yeah.
You're muted.
You're muted.
Perfect.
Okay. Hey!
I'm glad to not be here just in my imagination now.
Okay, can I just take a... few seconds to introduce Carl,
please.
Officially, welcome, Carl. Thank you for joining us. Carl Rapke is an embodiment teacher, Feldenkrais and structural integration practitioner. Carl, you're joining a fascinating conversation. I'm sure you'll add much more to it. So, over to you.
Could I ask you a leading question, Carl?
Please, Rachel.
When I suggested this subject to you and you said, yeah, sounds interesting. And then you went to sleep and the next morning you texted me and said, I had some great thoughts overnight. I would love to hear them. Could you put your background in the foreground as a starter for 10, just to open the subject?
Well, I was thinking of, just one of the primary acts of imagination is actually becoming ourselves, that's really the ultimate in creativity is being true to our own incarnation, or, you know, as Oscar Wilde says, you know, we have to be ourselves because everyone else is taken. And when it's connected to embodiment, when there's such a adherence to the sort of laws and rules of the head and the kind of reductionist, rational, and treating imagination as, oh, it was just my imagination, rather than holding the soulfulness of the imaginal world and how much is actually shaped by our imagination, if we allow it to be. So that was the first thing. You know, there's that great Octavio Paz poem that the path that the ancient ones walked is closed, and the wide path, everyone's path, goes nowhere. I am alone and I find my way. That there really is a fundamental imagining to walking our own path. So that was one thing that struck me in the morning. And then I was talking with my wife, Erin, and you know, she's done a lot with Johanna Macy and the work that reconnects. And I was been musing on just the imagination that's required right now for the times that we're in, and needing, you know, it can't be just consensus agreements or drawing on what's already known. It has to be drawing from different sources, which is, I think, also fundamental to finding our uniqueness, that we each have some piece of the imagination of what's going to come next. But in Johanna Macy's work that reconnects work, she has this beautiful, what's called the spiral, where it goes from this starting with gratitude and really building our resilience and appreciating the beauty and gifts of the world, and then going into grief, really letting ourselves be touched by the brokenheartedness. And that sort of tenderizes us into some possibility for seeing the world with new eyes. And what gratitude and grief bring to the imagination, that then we can go forth with something that's unprecedented. So that was another piece of, like, what supports this fresh, unprecedented participation and going forth into the world.
And we touched before, that's so beautiful, Carl, thank you. And we touched before on the idea of the necessity of stumbling around in the dark, the willingness to be in the dark and to not know. And that speaks to that really beautifully, because we can't know what we haven't created yet. And it's up to all of us, and every single one of us, to imagine what it might be and not know. And to be forward moving and open hearted in that, right? Yeah, and the undoing, I like what Bayo Akamalafe says about being undone, getting to a point of, if I can let myself get to a point of hopelessness sometimes, then from that compost, just accept the death of a thing, then from that compost, something new might be able to be imagined, a tiny little beginning of something, I don't know what, the tiniest little something might be able to begin to come into being, right?
Right, and Bio's line that he brings so often of, these times are urgent, we must slow down. That slowing down is an essential for something new to emerge, which is also, you know, fundamental principle to Moshe Feldenkrais's teaching. Like, if we don't slow down enough to actually see what the hell it is we're doing, we won't have any possibility of doing something different. We'll just repeat what has momentum. And so that slowing down to allow for a more organic emergence of something, I think, is also crucial to imagination.
And that brings me to another little subject I wanted to touch on, and we talked about and put in our blurb, I think, about the place between worlds. The place that for me, between, just as I'm drifting off to sleep, the place that I can access in psychedelic states, that I can access in trance work that I can access in creative states, flow states. And I'm curious to bring this subject alive because it feels like it's part of the big collective healing question as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
Has anyone got anything they'd love to dive into with that subject to begin with? You want to take it anywhere? Matthew or Carl or the hypnagogic state? That's the one, yeah.
Yes, there's something in a clinical moment where you've assessed and moved through and modeled and then where do you go with that? And there is something of a letting go of a clinical process, a task, and going to do something, and just being really present and not knowing, because I don't know what I'm going to do necessarily. Mm. Time changes, the patient becomes far bigger in my perception of them. Time slows right down, my awareness changes. I go out to the periphery and become aware my breath and my patient's breath are one and the same. Mm. And in that moment, something comes. There's a space that opens in that then starts to make sense of what needs to happen for both of us. But and then sometimes those lines get blurred. So there is something in a flow state experience of that that moves differently to, right, they've got a shoulder which won't move in a certain way, or they're coming with an angst and an anguish and a struggle with something, to I'm going to do an X and Y technique. It changes. And it's that shift in slowing down and moving into some kind of union, some kind of, yes, everywhere and nowhere state.
Yeah, for me, there's something about, I like the words big body intelligence, that in that place between waking and state and sleep, where my frontal cortex can take a bloody rest, there's a largeness that can come in, and information, a field of information that I can't access when I'm in my place of focused attention. Yeah, is this shared intuition? Sorry, Carl.
There's an element of grace too, you know, to those states. It's like, you know, thinking of imagination or thinking of dreams, like we often have the language of like, I had this dream, like it's my possession, or I have this idea, but that sense of like something dreaming us, something imagining us, and how ideas will emerge at different points in the field, like they have their own aliveness. And when you mentioned psychedelics too, I think, you know, part of the great resurgence of different kinds of plant medicines in terms of healing trauma and opening possibilities, I think, is the intelligence of the earth dreaming us into different ways of being with her. You know, different possibilities that show up in different ways, but it's like, oh, here's something being offered to us. And I think that's a fundamental piece too, is how do we kind of court these rather than thinking of possessing them, of like my insight or my discovery, but more of these things that are being offered to us.
Yes. And that touches on something for me of Joseph Campbell's work and the idea of the front brain getting obsessed with fact, truth, and detail, fact, truth, and the myth brain, the dream brain, the dream self, being able to focus on, or not focus is the wrong word. It's not the appropriate word. Be able to be with big truth. And big truth comes in mysterious form and symbolic form and archetypes and stories and fiction as well. You know, there's a dance and a sidewaysness, a way it comes in sideways. It doesn't come in direct like this. And to court it as part of your ordinary reality, as part of your everyday, feels like a missing piece of our everyday in our daily lives, in walking culture in cities, you know?
Yeah.
How do we re-inhabit our dreaming, right? Out of the corner of our eyes,
Mm-hmm.
if you have any questions to the presenter. Oh, out of the corner of your eye, yeah. Yeah, so re-inhabiting our dreaming and re-inhabiting this place, this hypnagogic place, and the dream, the place of dream, and the imaginal realms as ordinary parts of being, even though they're extraordinary states or there might be non-ordinary realities. How do they become living, breathing, integral parts of our being and our daily being, our daily lives? And I don't have the answer to that question, but it feels like a life quest.
Yeah.
As a Western, as a white Western person, it feels like a really urgent quest of mine.
Yeah, I love Michael Mead framed that as a lunar and solar knowledge. And like the solar knowledge is, you know, what's evident in the day and what we can see the facts, but the lunar, which is more connected to the body, like what's in the darkness in here, you know, what comes in places that aren't so known during the daytime. And I think that the whole notion of courtship is helpful. You know, how do we set up context? And a lot of it is, it seems like creating space for those sorts of things to emerge, whether it's, you know, through walks in nature or writing practices or something that allows those kind of channels in.
Yeah, for me, music does it for me immediately if I wear headphones and listen to music. And I'd love to just put to the people that are listening as an embodied experiment relating to imagination. How do you make space for that? How do you create room for that to rush in? Is it that place just before? Is it making a particular kind of quality of space before bed? Is it going for walks in nature, like Carl said, or listening to music or dance? And is there a way you can cultivate that? Because I do think it's part of the picture we're needing to kind of assemble if we're going to work out how to be a few more generations ahead on the planet. And this thing of needing to be known, needing everything to be known, is something that gets me as well. Needing to, why do we need everything to be known? What's that? There's a hypervigilance in the need to know. And imagination sits somewhere not there.
Yeah, I mean, I'm reminded of that Suzuki Roshi line of not knowing is most intimate. You know, that when we're able to really relax back into that, then we have intimacy with something.
That's beautiful. I'm just writing that shit down, Carl. Not knowing is most intimate. I love that. And Philip, sadly, who couldn't make it, because I think he thought it was maybe tomorrow night. The assumption is the unknown is threatening. Yeah, and that the darkness is threatening. And mythologically, we put darkness as bad in a lot of fairy tales and stories that we tell ourselves and films we watch. And Bonnie Bainbridge Cohen talks about some healing only happening in darkness, and all life is beget in moist darkness. All life is beget in moist darkness. And that's so potent. Someone just said, yeah, that's fine. Mm-hmm.
The Roman god Janus is where we get the name January from, and he was the guardian in thresholds. So the first of every month was named Janus Day. And the reason we carry a bride across a threshold when we get married, the reason that a Welsh lady would carry her husband across to his boat from land to sea, and the reason that a bugle is played at the start of a day and at the end of a night when a flag is drawn down in military camps, is about guardianship of identity, of that. And maybe there's a Western culture that's running through that holds a belief tight, that's something we've adopted. So that those veils are seen as a threat, that they're embodied in some way as a threat, not necessarily embraced. Janus had more people praying to him than Jupiter, which was the top honcho.
You do need tools to navigate darkness. Sorry, yes. Carl, what were you about to say?
No, I didn't. I was resonating with that.
Philip really wanted to talk about embodied meditation, and I'm going to let that subject dangle and not touch that. But what we might do is try and find a little place on Facebook where the three of us can have a little conversation that ripples out from this one. So keep an eye out for that.
I'd like to just share something that I personally have learned. I'm learning from Philip is that it's that to be sensitive to what is, that feeling of receptivity of being with what's happening and sensitive to what's going on around us and within us. And that word sensitive, being sensitive to what is, to me shifted a lot of things. It's like, oh, okay. It's a curiosity and imagination. It's like, oh, what that is. I just wanted to share, you know, a bit of Philip Shepherd.
That's beautiful. I'm so glad you brought a bit of Philip Shepherd in. Sorry, everyone, that we couldn't provide you with a Philip.
Well, and another thing that I love, Philip talks about intelligence in any realm as being a grounded sensitivity. And I think that grounding of the sensitivity is really important too, you know, because many people, if you know, highly sensitive person, or, you know, there's just so much to take in. And if we don't have the physiological infrastructure of hara, of connection with ground, of freedom of breath, then we get overwhelmed by the information. And that's where the body is so powerful for being able to ground that sensitivity in a way that it doesn't sort of knock us over, that we have to create tension patterns to numb ourselves.
Mm. Yes, and this question, is how I'm being sustainable? Is how I'm being at the level of my being in my nervous system? Is how I'm being with myself sustainable? I think that's a profound thing for me. I just never can get enough of asking myself that question, because it's sort of unanswerable a lot of the time when I'm charging around being a lunatic, doing too many things at once. Mm. Oh, well, there's a question about the quote. Who did you say the quote, the needing to be knowing is that not knowing is the most intimate thing, Carl?
Oh, not knowing is, that's, I believe, from Suzuki Roshi.
Ah, oh, Suzuki Roshi. There you go. Okay, great. So I think we need to wrap up, but that was such a juicy chat. Thank you. Thanks for jumping in, Matthew. We're so loving hearing your voice.
Thank you. Thank you, Adrian.
Thank you, Matthew. Wonderful to see you, Manal and Rachel. Sorry, yeah. I arrived late to the party.
No worries. I'm so glad you came. Thank you so much for coming. And I'll pop an opening thing on Facebook for the three of us to continue to open the subject up, because I feel like it's a really rich one.
Yeah, me too.
And I'll have to add, if you know anyone missed your session, Rachel or Carl or Philip has few sessions.
Or Manal's.
What?
You got a session too.
Yes. Mine is on parenting. And so thank you for plugging it in, Rachel. So you can go back and check those recordings if they're still free. And if they're not, you could buy the recording, rewatch them. I haven't seen one session that I didn't feel that, oh, I need to go back to it and stop and digest it. So, and I really love this metaphor, imagination of digesting the information that we're getting, because at some point when we get an overload with which is what this conference is lovingly providing, an overload of things coming in, it becomes too much to digest. So if you haven't already, go get the recording. I believe by the end of the conference, the prices will go up. So, and if there's anything that it's stopping you financially from getting the recording, please get in touch with us. And we'll reply at some point, maybe not right away, but we will. So thank you so much for joining us. It's been a lovely conversation. And like Rachel said, we could go and carry it over to the Facebook group. The coffee breaks are also there. I'm hearing a lot of people actually tuning in to just go into the coffee breaks. Yeah, keep the conversation going. And I think I wrapped it all up, what I'm supposed to be saying.
Sounds like it to me.
Yeah, and I'm gonna hand it back to you, Rachel, Carl, and Matthew as well. And I know each one of you had their session, so you had your top embodiment tip. So in terms of embodiment and imagination, or anything else you want to leave the viewers and the attendees with, what that would be?
Well, I would say, don't underestimate the power of imagining your full incarnation into being and imagining possibilities that we have no idea about into the future.
That's lovely. And I'd add to that, being prepared to not know is one of the most powerful things you can, and brave things you can do. One of the most creative things you can do.
Yeah. Yes, you've taken my mind away. That's exactly what I lead, or take my conversation, to embrace not knowing, to be completely okay with it. 30 years of clinical work, the more I study, the more I notice what I don't know. I don't know. And I've got to be comfortable with not knowing. I have to be okay with that. And it's a good place. It's okay. It's an okay place. It's a good place.
Yeah. Where do you choose to place yourself in relationship to not knowing? Is an interesting question.
I'll add mine.
Go. Anyway.
Because, you know, as we were talking about not knowing in terms of parenting, because this is my realm, my world now, is it's a lot about unknowing. Because as parents, what we are doing with our kids right now, we have no clue what would happen, you know, in years' time, or how they would grow up to be. So there's a lot of unknown, and just trusting that hopefully, maybe we're doing the right things with them right now, we'll get, you know, we'll be good, but it's pretty much unknown. So I'm inspired by this, and, you know, a big part of parenting is unknown. So thank you so much for this lovely conversation. I truly enjoyed it. And we'll see you. We still have a lot of sessions going on, if you believe it or not. There's a amazing panel discussion later in the day with the elders of the in the field. I don't see it right now here, but I think it's such a nice, big, juicy panel. And Ruby Wax, that's her name, right? Sorry, I butchered it, is on today. I'll check the schedule. Thank you so much, everyone, and have a good morning, evening, good afternoon, and be well.
Sleep. Bye. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.